So, good evening, everybody. And here we are. We have the chance to share the Dharma together again this evening. So it's a very precious opportunity. It means that we've created a lot of merit in our previous lives to be able to have a precious human life, to be able to encounter the Buddha's teachings and teachers, to be healthy, to have enough material things so we're not living in dire poverty, and, you know, all the conditions that we need to be able to listen to and practice the Buddha's teachings. So we're incredibly fortunate, and let's have a good time together this evening, okay? This evening we'll be talking about how to actualize your aspirations, and it's actually part of a guide to a Bodhisattva's way of life. I've been teaching from this book for the last, I don't know how many years, does anybody remember? You know, every year coming and then teaching part of it, and so we're on the last half of chapter 7 now, which is, chapter 7 is about joyous effort, how to put that into our practice. And so I'll review a little bit what we talked about and then go into the actual teaching. And my hope is that tonight we'll finish the rest of chapter 7. But maybe I shouldn't speak too soon. Let's generate our motivation. So since we're listening to the Buddha's teachings, let's try and have a motivation that is similar to the Buddha's. So the Buddha's big wish is to be of the greatest benefit to each and every living being, because he sees that all the beings equally want happiness and not suffering, and that they've all been kind, and yet they're all under the influence of afflictions and karma. So seeing sentient beings cycle in samsara, the Buddha has great compassion, because in their ignorance and confusion create the cause of misery, even though what we want is happiness. So may we, like the Buddha, also look at sentient beings with the eyes of compassion, seeing how they struggle in samsara, wanting them to be free, and then doing what we can to benefit them, both in temporal ways, to cease their suffering of this life, and also in long-term ways, by helping them to learn and practice the Dharma. So let's generate that altruistic intention and then learn how to practice with joyous effort. So, to fill you in on this project that started many years ago to teach Shantideva's text, which is called The Guide to Bodhisattva's Way of Life, or another translation is Engaging in the Bodhisattva's Deeds, or Engaging in the Bodhisattva's Conduct. So it was written by Shantideva, an 8th century Indian sage, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama says this is one of his favorite texts, and I have to say the same. And one reason I really love like it is because he's so honest. And he's talking to himself, but of course, what he says to himself, I need to say to myself. And he just cuts through all the rationalizations and justifications and excuses and just tells the truth. And I really like that approach. So, it has 10 chapters. The first one is the benefits of the bodhicitta. Okay? And the second is the disclosure of wrongdoing. And the third is the full acceptance or generation of bodhicitta. So those chapters are really preparing our motivation and getting us going in the right direction. The fourth chapter is about conscientiousness, yeah, and leads us into thinking about ethical conduct. Chapter 5 is about introspective awareness, so becoming more mindful and aware of our actions and thoughts. Okay, chapter 6, oh, this chapter saved my life so many times. It's on patience or fortitude, how to deal with anger. So, when I'm angry, I sit and read this chapter. And I sometimes read it a lot, but it always helps. If I could just request that the people who have beeping phones or whatever, you unbeep your phones, however you need to do that. Then chapter 7 is joyous effort. That's the chapter we're on, okay? So we practice with ethical conduct, with introspective awareness, we develop fortitude and patience in our practice, and then we need to practice with enthusiasm and joyous effort. So, in the chapter about enthusiastic and joyous effort, we talked about different types of joyous effort, and then we talked about four powers, and that's what we're in the middle of talking about now. So four powers or four qualities that we want to build up and enhance so that our enthusiasm and joyous effort for learning and practicing the Dharma can grow. Because, you know, if we're going to practice, we have to enjoy it. We have to want to. If you have no interest in the Dharma, and if in practicing it seems like a big burden, then you're not going to do it. Yeah. So this chapter is really helping us see the importance of practice and to get, you know, rev up our motivation. Okay, so the four powers that we talked about is the first one is aspiration or interest, and this pertains particularly to wanting to practice virtue and abandon non-virtue. Okay, so it isn't joyous effort, aspiration, interest in playing video games, okay, or watching the stock market reports. Yeah. It's for learning what to practice and what to abandon on the path to awakening. The second of the four powers is steadfastness. And so that is generating some stability in our practice, being able to have a stable mind. In other words, before we take on any Dharma projects, or before we say we're going to do retreat or whatever kind of Dharma we're going to do, then to really, before we promise, to investigate and check, can we do it? Yeah. Do we have enough time? Do we have the skills? And after we've checked, then to make the commitment. Okay? And once we've made the commitment, then finish what we have said that we're going to do. So in other words, really value our word. When we give our word, we're going to do a certain practice, then we do it. Okay? And this is true also in our ordinary lives. Yeah? Our word has to be well thought out before we promise to do something, and then to really keep our word unless other circumstances come in and intervene. Okay? So, for example, if you volunteer to do something at a Buddhist center, before you volunteer, really understand what the task is. See if you have the time, if you have the skill, if you have the interest. If that's all in place, then volunteer. Okay? And if you volunteer, then make sure you complete it by the time that it is needed. Don't wait until the day before when somebody's expecting you to do something, and then all of a sudden say, oh, well, I didn't have time, or I can't make it, or whatever, and you leave somebody high and dry. Okay? So, you know, sometimes we are over-enthusiastic and we volunteer to do things that we really don't have the time to do. Sometimes we have the time, we really want to do them, and then something uncontrollable comes up. A family member gets sick or something like that happens, and then we can't complete it, in which case then we let whoever is depending on us know so that they can make other arrangements. Okay? But we want to be steadfast. We want to be a reliable person. And don't you think that's a good quality? When you look for friends, qualities in friends, is reliability a quality that you look for in people that you become good friends with? Yeah? Okay, so it's the same in our Dharma practice. Then the third of these powers is joy. So this is an attitude of, just delight. And whatever we Dharma project or study or whatever that we said we're going to do, then we continue it. We undertake it, we're really happy. We're not dragging our feet like, oh God, I gotta go to Dharma class tonight. And I'm supposed to have read this chapter, but I really am not. You know, if you have that attitude towards a spiritual practice, you're not gonna do it, you know. So we really want to cultivate a very happy attitude so that we look forward to our meditation practice. We enjoy our study, okay? And we're never satiated. Yeah, we always say, wow, you know, that practice was good. And okay, maybe I didn't do it A number one in the perfect way, but I sure feel a lot better having done it. And I want to do something more. Okay? So a mind that really is enthusiastic and taking delight in practicing virtue. Okay? Not being content. Not saying, okay, I recited 100,000 Vajrasattva. That's good enough. Now I can go out to the pub and get drunk. No. Okay? Okay, so the joy is, the third power. And then the fourth power, you'll like this one, is called rest. So what this means is after you've completed a project after you've finished your study of the text, after you've finished your retreat, yeah, before taking up a new project, rest, yeah, rejuvenate your energy. And so that then the next thing you do, you're well rested and you're enthusiastic about. Okay? So we were in the middle of talking about all these things, and in the text, I was reading verse by verse, and so we stopped on verse 58, and we're going to start on verse 59. Okay, so I have to find it on here. Okay, so here in this section where we're starting, because we finished up to verse 58 last year, is we're on the topic of joy. No, we're on the topic of steadfastness. And in order to be steadfast, then we need to have self-confidence. Okay, so verse 59. Yeah. So what it's talking about here is we need to have self-confidence. But sometimes, instead of self-confidence, we have arrogance. We get those two confused. So it says, whoever seizes self-confidence in order to conquer the enemy of self-importance, they are the self-confident ones, the victorious heroes. And in addition, whoever definitely conquers the spread of this enemy of self-importance completely wins the fruit of a conqueror, fulfilling the wishes of the world. Okay? So we, like I said, we often confuse self-confidence with self-importance. And by self-importance, I'm meaning the mind that says, I'm such a big shot. I'm so perfect. Okay. So that kind of mind really doesn't have a role in Dharma practice, because the mind of self-importance is a mind of self-centeredness. And self-centeredness or selfishness is the opposite of the compassion and love that we want to generate, that will motivate us to become a Buddha and to be of great benefit for sentient beings. Okay, so let's look at the difference between self-confidence and self-importance. Okay? Self-confidence, when we have self-confidence, we don't need to puff up ourselves. We don't need to go around proving ourselves, telling other people how intelligent we are, how great we are, how much better we are than the other person. Instead, with self-confidence, there's a certain kind of peace. And we're not trying to prove ourselves, yeah, or impress anybody. And so we can actually be humble. When we have self-importance, then we're trying to prove ourselves, impress people, gain a good reputation, broadcast all of our good qualities. Yeah. And often we do this because we don't really believe in ourselves. Because if we really believed in ourselves, we wouldn't have to do a tap dance to try and impress other people. Okay. So one of my teachers, one time, we were talking about this, and he said, if I'm a good cook, I don't need to go around and tell the world, I am a great cook. You know, I'm better than anybody else. You should come eat my meals. He said, you don't need to do that. You just cook a meal, and then people will see that you're a good cook. Yeah. So just mind your own business. Do what you do. If you have good qualities, people will notice. Okay. Now, I know that that view is not popular in Singapore, and it's not popular in my country either. Because in both those places, you know, when you go for a job interview, what do? Yeah, they ask you, can you do this? Oh, yes, of course, even though you don't know what they're talking about. Can you do this? Oh, that's no problem. You have no clue what's going on. You know, you puff yourself up. You make outrageous statements, you know, because you want to get the job. And then you get the job, and they find out that you don't know anything. And then it's a little bit embarrassing. And then you're stressed out because all of a sudden you have to cram and learn all these things that you boasted about knowing that you didn't know. Okay? So I actually think it's much better to be honest about our capabilities when we are applying for a job. I once talked to someone who was on the admissions board for graduate students. And I asked him, what qualities, when you're looking at graduate students' applications, what qualities do you look for? And he said, I look at how they deal with failure. I look at how they cope with failure, because whenever you're pursuing a career or learning something, you're going to have bumps in the road, you're going to make mistakes, you're going to fail. It's a given, because we're not perfect beings. So then the thing is, how does a person deal with a situation in which they mess up? Do they cover it up? Do they blame somebody else? Do they justify it? Do they lie? Or are they honest about it? Or do they just fail and then they give up, they quit? Yeah. Or do they own their mistake, pick themselves up, learn from the mistake, and continue on? So he said that's what he looks for when he's choosing graduate students, how they respond to failure. I thought that was pretty good. When my niece was applying for college, they wanted her to write something, you know, about herself. And I suggested, you know, because she was going to talk about her good qualities, which she has many of, and I said, you should also talk about your weaknesses and faults. Well, my sister-in-law was furious. My niece was angry. That was not what they wanted to hear. But I know for myself, if I look at applications, I want to see, can somebody evaluate their own abilities well? Or are they faking it? Yeah, I want to really see. So, you know, it's a quality I look for. But when we're self-important, we don't want to be honest. We build up, you know, a pile of excuses, and we humiliate other people, anything, so that we don't lose face and look bad. But I think, if we're really a Dharma practitioner, we need to gracefully lose faith,
face.
Yeah. So, you know, we blundered. Let's be graceful about it. I watched this one time. His Holiness, it was in 1989, and His Holiness Dalai Lama had just won the Nobel Peace Prize. And he was speaking at a conference of experts in Southern California. And I was able to listen, I was listening to the conference. And so some point of discussion came up. And they asked His Holiness, you know, what's the answer? Because he was the expert among all the experts on the panel. Okay? So he's the expert of the experts. They pose a question, and His Holiness says, I don't know. And the whole auditorium was so quiet. The expert of experts said, I don't know. In America, that never happens. Yeah. And then His Holiness not only said, I don't know, he turned to all the other people on the panel and he said, what do you people think? So he was completely humble. Yeah? And he was totally okay about that. Yeah, totally okay. So that was a really good example for me. You know, that when you actually have self-confidence, you can be humble. When you don't have self-confidence, then you try and build yourself up by making false claims, excuses, attacking other people, blaming other people. I won't mention who in my country is the expert in doing that these days, okay? But maybe you can guess. Yeah, it's pretty obvious how insecure this person is. Because if you are self-confident, you don't need to lie, you don't need to attack others, you don't need to call them names. Yeah. You're able to respect other people and point out their good qualities without feeling like you have to, you know, smash everybody and humiliate them to show that, you know, you're King Kong. Okay. So that's verse 59. Yeah. Yes, he's a perfect example of so many qualities I don't want to have. But it's good, you know? Because when we see people with qualities that we don't want to have, and we see the problems with having those qualities, it really helps us change our behavior. Yeah? Because, you know, they're showing us what we look like when we act like that. Okay? And it's like, I don't really want to act like that. I don't want to look like that to other people. Okay, then verse 60. If I find myself amidst a crowd of disturbing conceptions, I shall endure them in a thousand ways, like a lion among foxes. I will not be affected by this disturbing host. So sometimes it happens that our mind is just overwhelmed with mental afflictions, with anger and jealousy or arrogance or all sorts of things. So when this happens, yeah, then don't give up and don't let those afflictions take over our mind and control our lives. Yeah? Be like a lion amongst foxes. Yeah? Is the lion going to be afraid of foxes? I don't think so. Yeah? Foxes are clever, but the lion is more powerful. So our mental afflictions, yeah, might be cleverly trying to sabotage our mind, but we remain steady. We don't let them take control. Verse 61, just as men will guard their eyes when great danger and turmoil occur, likewise I shall never be swayed by the disturbances within my mind, even at times of great strife. Okay, so times of great strife, there might be political problems in your country, there might be protests or something going on, there might be strife in your family, there might be a scandal at your workplace, okay? So any kind of difficult situation, you know, where our mental afflictions could arise and our confusion could arise and take over the situation, yeah, we don't let our disturbing emotions have power over us. Yeah, we recognize them, we apply the antidote with joyous effort, we release the disturbing emotion. Okay? So this is building up our confidence to be able to do that. Yeah? Did you have any disturbing emotions arise today? Anybody get angry today? Anybody get greedy today? Anybody get jealous? Anybody arrogant? Anybody get confused? Or maybe you're all perfect beings. Okay? So, you know, this happens on a daily basis. So recognize these, learn the antidotes, apply them, let it go. Okay, verse 62. It would be better for me to be burned, to have my head cut off, and to be killed, rather than ever bowing down to those ever-present disturbing conceptions or afflictions. So likewise, in all situations, I should do nothing other than what is fit or what is suitable. Okay. So, this is pretty drastic, isn't it? It would be better for me to be burned, to be killed, or have my head cut off. Yeah? In other words, it would be better for ISIS to take me prisoner. Yeah? Oh, who wants that? Rather than bowing down to the enemy of the afflictions, the disturbing emotions. Now, why would Shantideva say that? Yeah? It's because if another person harms us, the worst harm anybody could ever do to us is to kill us, to take our life away. Nobody else can send us to the hell realm. They may say, I want you to go to hell, but that won't make us be born in the hell realms. What makes us be born in the hell realms? Our own mental afflictions. When we explode in anger, when we are jealous and manipulate other people, when we are pretentious and deceptive, okay? When we are violent, either physically or verbally, yeah, these actions of ours, they are the cause for us to have a hellish rebirth. Nobody else, No external person can cause us that degree of suffering. Only the real enemy is in our own heart, these disturbing emotions. And that's what our mind sounds like when the disturbing emotions are running. Yeah. You ever have that kind of mental chatter in your mind? Okay. So, yeah. So this verse 62 is saying, I'm not going to let this confusion just take over my mind. Yeah, I'm gonna, you know, sit and really think about what is suitable to do in this situation. Yeah, so instead of just following any idea that pops in our mind, which we always do, yeah, do you do that? Some idea pops in your mind and then it's coming out of your mouth. And while it's coming out of your mouth, you're going, why don't I shut up? Yeah, look at what I'm saying. This, I don't want to say this. This is going to bring me a lot of problems. And we keep saying it. Yeah? So we want to stop that. We want to really do only what is suitable in the situation. What will create peace, what will create harmony, yeah? What will diffuse a very divisive situation where there's a lot of strife. Okay, then we will go on. Verse 63. So the verse 63 is where we start talking about the power of joy. Okay? So remember those four powers? So it's the power of joy. So the verse says, just like those who yearn for the fruits of play, bodhisattvas are attracted to whatever task they may do. They never have enough. It only brings them joy. Okay, so whatever a bodhisattva is doing, taking out the garbage, mopping the floor, in a boring meeting at work, with an uncooperative colleague, whatever a bodhisattva is involved in, they love it. Okay, they say that when a beggar comes to a bodhisattva and says, give me something, that the happiness the bodhisattva experiences is greater than an arhat's delight of being in nirvana. So that means they're really happy. Why? Because a bodhisattva's deepest heartfelt wish is to be a benefit to others. And here's somebody coming saying, I need something. So a bodhisattva is going, yippee, I can help somebody. Okay? They feel so happy at being able to help. Yeah? So that's the kind of joy that we want to cultivate in our Dharma practice. Okay? So, how are we now when people ask us to do things? Well, I'm really busy, so sorry I can't. I already did something like that, so ask somebody else. Who are you to tell me what to do? Okay, you know, somebody asks us to do some small thing. Oh, you know, one of the 5,993 excuses pops into our mind immediately for why we can't do it. Whereas, If we just said yes and had a positive attitude, we would create so much merit. The other person would be happy. We'd be happy. Yeah. But instead, you know, I don't want anybody to boss me around. Nobody can tell me what to do. Yeah. You think I don't know about these things. You try being an abbess of a monastery. Yeah. I was a professional before I ordained. Don't ask me to wash the dishes. Why not? They're dirty. Somebody's got to clean them. Yeah. You want me to clean them? Yes, I think it would be good if the abbess did the dishes. Okay, so this is how we are. You know, sometimes we just, being cooperative is not always our strong point. Okay, but this is, you know, this verse is really an aspiration for being cooperative and being cooperative with joy. I remember one time being with one of my students. He was the abbot of Saraje Monastery in South India. And we were in his room. He had offered a few of us a meal, and we were eating. And our teacher, the abbot, cooked the food for us. He made us sit on chairs at a table. He sat on the ground.
Really?
Really. This is the abbot, the one that wrote Practical Ethics and Profound Emptiness, the book on the precious garland. This was him. So we're sitting there eating. I was so embarrassed. It's like, Genma, I'm going to sit on the floor. No, you sit on that chair. Okay? Yeah. So we're sitting there eating, and a beggar comes in the monastery and comes up to the door. The door's open because it's hot. And I don't hear what happens, but clearly, you know, this very dirty, raggedy old man is asking for something. So Ken Rinpoche goes into another room, and I see him coming out with a blanket, a nice blanket, a clean blanket. And he hands it to the beggar, and then the beggar goes down the stairs and goes away. And then he comes in and sits down. And I thought, oh, that's what it means to take joy in giving, to give without attachment. You know, the beggar just shows up, and yeah, I can give you a blanket. And he gave him a nice blanket. You know, when people ask me for things, usually I find an excuse why I can't give it. And then if I really can't get out of it, I give them the worst thing, not the best thing, okay? When I get some nice food, I hoard it away, yeah? And then if I have to share something, then it's, you know, what's left over. What, you know, I've already opened the package and decided I didn't like it, so then I give it away. Okay? So I just, you know, these incidents with my teacher, you know, I have several teachers, just they stay in my mind, and it's like, okay, this is an illustration of what Shantideva is talking about and how much I have to grow and change and transform my own mind. I remember another time, I was living somewhere, and one monk had, I was living across the street from the monastery. The nuns were living in a separate building. And the garbage had just been put out that night. This was in the U.S. And so the garbage cans needed to be taken back in. So this monk had come down the driveway, and he was going to take the garbage can back up the hill. And I saw him, and I thought, oh, I feel, you know, I'll go do it. You know, I just felt like the spontaneous thought was, I'll help him, and I'll take some of the garbage cans up the hill. And then my mind said, oh, but I know that monk, and he sometimes is not very pleasant to be with. And if I volunteer to do something, he'll probably scold me. Because one other time before that, I had volunteered to help him, and he got mad at me. So then I thought, okay, I won't volunteer. You know, he can take the trash cans up. And then afterwards I thought, you know, I should have been more courageous, because my natural impulse was to help. And then I backed down out of fear that he would scold me like he did once before. No, I should have just gone ahead, and if he, you know, says something mean, that's his business. I don't need to be affected by it. Yeah. So next time, I'm not sure when that will be, but I will try and follow through and take the garbage cans or do whatever else needs to be done. Okay, so bodhisattvas do this to whatever task they may do. They never have enough. It only brings them joy. Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? Whatever you do, so happy to do it. Then 64, although people work in order to be happy, it is uncertain whether or not they will find it. They will find happiness. But how can those whose work itself is joy find happiness unless they do it? So people in ordinary life, they work in order to be happy. Yeah, you go to work because you want to be happy. And what's going to make you happy? Money. So you go to work to earn the money so that you can not only stay alive, but then go and do some fun things. Okay? But even though you work in order to be happy, it's uncertain whether you will actually be happy. Because you earn the money, you go out and do the fun things, but sometimes the fun things aren't very fun. Yeah. Have you ever planned a vacation? Yeah, an ideal vacation. You've gone on your vacation with somebody you care about, and then that person is in a bad mood the entire vacation. That ever happened to you? Or you go on this wonderful vacation and you're sick the whole time. Yeah. My niece, another niece, when she got married, they went on their honeymoon to Hawaii. She was sick the whole honeymoon. In Hawaii, you know, couldn't even go on the beach. Okay? So we work hard to be happy, but we don't necessarily get the happiness that we want. Okay? You work hard to go buy your red sports car. Yeah? You get your red sports car, really cool red sports car. And then you got a lemon instead of a sports car, because it breaks down. Yeah, it breaks down here. It doesn't start in the morning when you turn it on. You have it fixed. You take it to the shop and have it fixed. It still doesn't work. You get a flat tire. On and on, yeah? Did you ever buy something that turned out to be a lemon? Do you have that expression in Singapore? Yeah, a lemon, yeah. You get a new something that you really want, and it doesn't work properly. Okay? So we try very hard to be happy, but it's not assured. But for bodhisattvas, okay, how can those whose work itself is joy find happiness unless they do it? So how can people who love being of service to other sentient beings, who find nothing better that they want to do than to benefit living beings and lead them to awakening, yeah, they can't be happy unless they do that. Okay. So it's completely the opposite for us. But it's really showing us how it's possible to transform the mind so that everything we do becomes something we take delight in, something we look at with enthusiasm. Okay? I get to wash the dishes instead of I've got to wash the dishes. Okay? So, this also reminds me of what something His Holiness Dalai Lama says, you know, because he's always talking about compassion and the necessity, the importance for compassion. And he says that sometimes when we are compassionate, we would really like somebody to say thank you. Or we would like them to acknowledge what we did. Or maybe even repay the favor. Or maybe tell other people how kind and generous we are so we have a good reputation. You know, we would like some ego benefit out of our compassion. But His Holiness says that when He's compassionate, He's the one who benefits more than the recipient of the compassion. Because we usually think that the recipient of the compassion is the one who gets the better end of the deal. Because somebody's giving something to them or doing something for them. His Holiness says no, that He, when He's compassionate, yeah, has more benefit and more happiness than the person He's trying to benefit. Because when you try and help somebody, the thank you is not guaranteed. Okay, they may not thank you. Sometimes they may not listen to what you say, what the advice you give. Sometimes they may even be hostile towards the help you give. And sometimes they might totally ignore you. So he says, you know, when you do something to help somebody, you can't control the outcome. So if you're hoping that that person's response will give you happiness, don't count on it. But if you really give with a compassionate heart, then you feel so happy to give, to benefit, that how the other person responds doesn't matter. Yeah? You just feel from your side, I'm so happy to benefit somebody. So I'll tell you a story of how I failed doing this one time. I was in Knoxville, Tennessee. This was many years ago. And I had just been giving a teaching on the mind training, the seven-point mind training. And in there, there's a section on practicing the five powers during your life and at the time of death, or the five forces. There's different ways to translate it. And so the five forces all revolve around being kind, being compassionate, creating merit, doing the right thing, you know, not being self-centered. So I had just gotten done teaching the seminar. It went very well. I was going to fly back to Seattle, where I was living at that time. And I got on the plane, and I had reserved an aisle seat. Yeah, because, I mean, we all know what middle seats on the plane are like. Okay, especially when you're sitting between two people that weigh, you know, 150 kg. Okay, and you're just trying to breathe. Okay, so I arrived, I went down the aisle, and I got to my seat, and somebody was sitting in it. And I said, oh, this is my seat. See my boarding pass, this is my seat. And that person said, yeah, I know, I have the middle seat. I was really hoping to be able to sit in the aisle because, you know, I'm tired or I don't feel well or whatever it was. And I said, yeah, but I reserved the seat, so please, you know, move over to your seat. Okay, I just got done teaching 2 days about being kind, being compassionate, not being selfish. Okay, and as soon as I said that, I just felt so much remorse. And so I said, well, let's just trade the seat. I'll sit in half the flight and you sit in the end. And they said, no, no, no. So then I just felt, you know, I really blew it. And I thought, you know, if I had only had the mind that said, yeah, just as I like sitting in an aisle seat, this person would feel really happy sitting in the aisle seat. Yeah? And that person's happiness is important. And the ability to make that person happy, even on such a small, temporary thing, that would make me happy. But I crashed. I didn't do it, you know? But I remember this. You know, sometimes when you really mess up, you remember it big time. And then, yeah, and then you really try and change in the future. Yeah. So one time, after that time, the flight attendant, we were on a flight that was completely full, and the flight had been delayed. I was, you know, in a bad mood because it was delayed, and I had to take a different route and everything. And the flight attendant says, you know, could somebody change with this person? Up ahead a few rows, it's an aisle seat. And I thought, oh, okay, it's an aisle seat, I'll change. So I said yes. So I changed. Well, the person who was sitting in the middle seat next to me was somebody who I think must have weighed at least 200 kgs. Really, seriously, this person was enormous. And she was spilling over, you know, from her seat into my seat. And I was like in my seat, in one little corner, like this. Yeah, because she was so enormous. And I just said, okay, yeah. You know, I sat there and I thought, you know, now I know why somebody wanted to change that seat. Yeah. But this was kind of, you know, my payback for being so selfish before. But I really, you know, when I saw her, you know, when we got off the plane, you know, I stood up and went, and she had such trouble moving. It was extremely difficult for her to stand up and walk. And I think, you know, they had to get a wheelchair or something. Yeah. And when I saw her with that kind of difficulty walking because of her body size, I just felt like, wow, you know, what suffering this person has. And then I was sorry that I didn't at least talk to her during the flight. Yeah. I was just like, you know, can I breathe? But she was really suffering. Okay, 65. If I feel that I never have enough sensual objects, which are like honey smeared on a razor's edge, then why should I ever feel that I have enough merit which ripens in happiness and peace? Okay? This verse is very important. So us common beings, we don't really understand what is the cause of happiness and what is the cause of suffering. We think sense objects are the cause of happiness. I want my car. I want a new computer, I want jewelry, I want these clothes, I want a certain kind of house, I want pretty things in the house, I want sports equipment, I want this, I want that, I want the other thing, okay? And so this is, we're never sated, we're never satisfied with no matter how many things we accumulate. We always could use something more. Can't we? Yeah? Are you ever happy with how much you have? Anybody here have enough money? No, it doesn't matter how much you have. You never have enough. Okay? So we always want more, better. Yeah? So we're never satisfied with sense objects, but our attachment to sense objects, it's like honey on a razor blade, okay? If you have honey on a razor blade, what's going to happen if you lick the honey?
You have to do it very carefully.
Yeah? It's going to taste sweet and you're going to get hurt. So our attachment to sense objects is similar. We want them. They look like honey. If I only had this, if I only had that, if I could only get this or that, if I could only be with this person, if I could only go on that vacation. But because we're attached to it, you know, and the attachment makes us do negative actions in order to get what we want, and those negative actions ripen in our own suffering in future lives, or even in this life, yeah, that attachment to the sense objects is like honey on a razor blade. Yeah, we go to get the sense objects and, ooh, goody, I got it. And we get caught, we get hurt. Because we create negative karma under the influence of our affections. Okay? But we're not, still, in spite of that, we're not satisfied with the sense objects. We always want more and better, more and better, more and better. Okay? Yet, so, but he's saying, yeah, why then am I not satiated by merit, which is the cause of happiness, which will ripen in peacefulness and delight in my life? Yeah. Why don't I have the same attitude towards creating virtuous deeds and creating merit, feeling, you know, always wanting more and better? Why don't I have that feeling towards the cause of suffering? I mean, towards the cause of happiness. Yeah. Why I create merit and then I said, oh, good enough. Yeah. I offered the Buddha, you know, one apple today. That's good enough. I created enough merit. Okay. I said Om Mani Padme Hum 21 times. Good enough. Finished. Okay. We're always satisfied with the little merit we create, but we're unsatisfied by having wealth and possessions. Yeah. So somehow we're upside down. It should be the other way. Yeah. Where we're not content with the amount of merit we create. And we always want to create more merit. We always want to serve other sentient beings more. Okay, so to really reverse that in our mind. Okay, 66. Thus, in order to complete this task, I shall venture into it, just as an elephant tormented by the midday sun plunges into a cool, refreshing lake. Okay, so in India, yeah, in the sun, in pre-monsoon times, it is so hot, even hotter than Singapore. In Delhi, it gets up to 45 degrees. You can fry an egg on the hood of a car. It's that hot, okay? So you're an elephant in that kind of heat, yeah? All the elephant wants is to get in a pool of cool water. He jumps into the pool of cool water. He says, oh, that feels so good. Okay? So just like that, we want to have so much joy and enthusiasm to complete whatever project, whatever retreat, whatever study, whatever thing, virtuous activity that we started out to do. That kind of happiness, like an elephant going in a cool pool on a hot summer day. Okay? Maybe if that example doesn't get you, think of what a starving person in Darfur would feel if somebody came up and just gave them a bottle of water and a biscuit. That kind of happiness after you've been starving. Okay? So let us take that much joy in creating virtue. Okay, so that's the power of joy. With verse 67, verse 67 is about the power of rest, or sometimes they translate it, the power of relinquishment. But it says, when my strength declines, I should leave whatever I am doing in order to be able to continue with it later. Having done something well, I should put it aside with the wish to accomplish what will follow. Okay, so when we've been working hard, doing something virtuous, and we're tired, and we're weary, our strength declines, then take a break. Don't push yourself. Yeah, saying, but I've got to be the biggest bodhisattva around here, you know. No, don't do that. Okay, so you need a break, take it. And when you can finish what you've done, feel glad, feel satisfied. Say, put it aside with a feeling of completion, rest, so that when you start your next virtuous project, you feel quite refreshed and enthusiastic. Okay? So don't push yourself. Now, I know for Singaporeans, that one's hard, okay? Because your whole life you're taught, be better, be the best, get ahead, beat out the other guy. Don't be weak. Aren't you? Yeah. And Shantideva is saying, no, be reasonable. When you're tired, rest. When you've completed something, rejoice. Take a break. Go back and do something more later on with enthusiasm, with joy. Okay? Then verse 69 is, 68. Yeah, this starts a new section, which is about being mindful, being diligent through having mindfulness and introspective awareness. Okay? So 68 says, just as a seasoned warrior approaches, it shouldn't say old warrior, because, you know, then you think of, you know, somebody who's 80 years old going to, you know, that's not, it's a seasoned warrior, an experienced warrior. Okay? So just as a seasoned warrior approaches the swords of an enemy upon the battlefront, so shall I avoid the weapons of the disturbing conceptions and skillfully bind this enemy. Okay, so an experienced warrior, when they go to fight, they do two things. They avoid the other person's weapons, and they try and bind their enemy, okay, conquer their enemy. So in the same way, yeah, when we are, you know, doing our virtuous project, if the afflictions arise, then we try and avoid being hurt by them, and we try to conquer them, apply the antidote and subdue them. Okay? Then 69, if someone dropped a sword during a battle, they would immediately pick it up out of fear. Likewise, if I lose the weapon of mindfulness, I should quickly retrieve it, being afraid of hell. Okay. This doesn't mean that you have to be like, oh, I'm so afraid of going to hell. No, it's not talking about that. Okay? But what is it talking about? The analogy. You know, somebody's in a battle and they drop their sword. Yeah. So if you drop your sword in the middle of a battle, you don't just stand there and go, the sword's on the ground, what do I do? You know, you immediately pick it up. Okay. So, similarly, when we're practicing the Dharma, if we lose our mindfulness, if we forget about our ethical conduct, yeah, if our mind becomes heedless, if we don't care about creating virtue, and we don't care about what we do, and we don't look at our thoughts, you know, to see if they're virtuous or non-virtuous, that's like dropping the sword on the battlefield. It leaves us very open to harm from the enemy, and the enemy is the afflictions. Okay? So just as the warrior would pick up the sword, if we've, you know, dropped our mindfulness and our introspective awareness, we need to immediately recall them, bring our mind back. Okay? So mindfulness here is remembering our values, remembering our precepts, remembering the kind of person we want to be. And introspective awareness is checking up what we're doing and making sure that our actions are corresponding with that. Okay? So this is an antidote about being heedless and sloppy, okay? Yeah. And some environments we go into, we get heedless and sloppy, yeah? You go into a party where people are drinking, you have a little bit to drink, Yeah, what happened? Oh, I feel so good. Yeah. And you think, I'm not drunk. I took the fifth precept, not to take intoxicants. That, to me, that means not get intoxicated. But of course, you don't know you're intoxicated until you're intoxicated. Yeah. So you don't know that you've drunk too much until after you've drunk too much. Yeah. And then, after you've drunk too much, what happens? Yeah? Okay. I work with inmates in prison. I would say 99.9% of them were intoxicated when they did whatever they did that landed them in prison. Okay. Drunk driving. Any of you know somebody who's got killed by, who was killed by a drunk driver? You know? It's horrible. Horrible. Okay? So, we don't want to lose our mindfulness and introspective awareness. If we do, we want to notice it and call them back up again. Okay. 70. Just as poison spreads throughout the body in dependence upon the circulation of blood, likewise, if a disturbing conception or an affliction finds an opportunity, unwholesomeness will permeate my mind. Okay, so if you get cut and you don't disinfect it and some germs get in, you know, they can travel through your blood and you may wind up with sepsis or, you know, some kind of illness. So in a similar way, yeah, if an affliction comes in our mind, that affliction may spread throughout our whole mind and make us completely nutty, you know. Like you have a little bit of anger and then you don't take care of your anger when it's small, and then before you know it, you are raging and everybody in your family is hiding in their rooms with the doors closed, because who wants to be around you when you're raging? Okay? So, that's verse 70 is a warning like that. 71. Those who practice should be as attentive as a frightened person carrying a jar full of mustard oil who is being threatened by someone with a sword and told that he will be killed if he spills just one drop. Okay? So, you have a little thing of mustard oil, yeah, on your head. Maybe even there's a wick in it and it's burning. And somebody is nearby with a sword saying that if you spill even one drop, you're going to get it. And you'll get it from the person who's following you, but you'll get burned as well from the wick and the oil. Okay. If you're in that situation, are you going to be careful? Are you going to be mindful? Are you going to have introspective awareness and watch what you do? You bet. Okay? So it's like, you know, there are people who walk across Niagara Falls on a tightrope. Have you ever watched a film of somebody do that? Yeah? It's scary. And because of Niagara Falls, the water's just crashing. And there's this one little tightrope going across. Yeah. If you're walking across Niagara Falls on a tightrope, Yeah, you aren't going to be daydreaming. Yeah, you aren't going to fall asleep. You're not going to be careless. You're going to pay incredible attention to what you do. Yeah, so that you don't make a mistake. So Santi Deva is encouraging us to have that kind of attentiveness in our actions so that these disturbing emotions don't take over our mind and make us create non-virtue or break our precepts or say something mean or lie or whatever. Okay? 72. Just as I would swiftly stand up if a snake came into my lap, likewise, if any sleep or laziness occurs, I shall quickly turn it back. That one is pretty clear, isn't it? If a snake came into your lap, are you going to sit there and go, oh, sweetie pie, you're so cute? Yeah. No, you're going to stand up. Okay, so similarly, if we start getting drowsy or lazy in the middle of our practice, in the middle of teachings, whatever, we're going to wake ourselves up. 73. Each time something unwholesome occurs, I should criticize myself. It doesn't mean criticize ourselves like, I'm such a horrible person, what a jerk I am. It means I shall evaluate my own actions and give myself good advice. Okay? So each time something unwholesome occurs, I shall evaluate my actions, give myself good advice, and then contemplate for a long time that I shall never let this happen again. Okay? So if we wind up doing something non-virtuous, breaking our precepts or whatever, we don't just say, well, doesn't matter, it's okay, I'll confess it, no problem, you know. No, we try and purify our destructive actions. We try and make amends to whoever we harmed. We change our attitude towards whoever we harmed. We make a determination not to act like that again in the future. Okay? Then 74, likewise, in all these situations, I shall acquaint myself with mindfulness. With this motivation as a cause, I shall aspire to meet with teachers or accomplish the tasks they assign me. Okay, so making a firm decision to be mindful, to know our precepts, know our values, act in accordance with them, be aware of what we're thinking, saying, and doing. Okay, and if we do this, and we act with the proper motivation, then we can dedicate the merit to meet with really fully qualified Mahayana teachers and to accomplish the teachings that they give us or the offering service work that they assign to us. Okay. 75. In order to have strength for everything, I should recall before undertaking any action the advice in the chapter on conscientiousness and then joyfully rise to the task. Okay? So before we undertake any tasks in order to have strength and joyous effort, we should review the chapter on conscientiousness that talked about the value of keeping good ethical conduct and the disadvantage of not keeping good ethical conduct. And if we remember that, then we will live a very virtuous life. When the time of our death comes, we will feel peaceful. Yeah, we won't have regrets. And then 76, just as the wind blowing back and forth controls the movement of a piece of cotton, so shall I be controlled by joy, and in this way accomplish everything. So the analogy is, if you have some cotton and the wind is blowing, the wind just takes the cotton, no problem, and blows it around. So in the same way, shall I be controlled by joy. So I'm like the cotton, and the wind is my joy. Okay? So may I be controlled by joy, and do everything in my life with compassion, and be totally happy to do that. Okay? So with that, we finished chapter 7. And our time is nearly finished as well. Okay. So next year we'll start chapter 8, which is on meditation. And chapter 8 is a really good chapter. Yeah. Well, this whole book is really good. So we can do a few questions or comments if you have them.
So tonight I heard you loud and clear say quite a few times that we should resist what society tells us, to push ourselves and say we're the best at this, we're very good at that. My question is, what if that behavior is needed in order to do something else, to be of service? For example, what if you need to promote yourself so that you can be in a position to do some kind of work that is your duty or fuels your responsibility of service to others? I don't know which one.
Okay. If you want to do some good work and you have the qualities and abilities to do it, then you can truthfully say, yes, I have the ability to do that. Without saying, I have the ability to do it, and you are so lucky if you hire me. Okay? So what I'm saying is, if there's beneficial work that you want to do, make yourself qualified to do it, and then you don't need to lie and you don't need to boast. You can simply own your good qualities, and then, you know, you can go ahead and do the project. Okay.
I think what she's also saying is that you can also sell yourself, but also keep realizing with the mindfulness that you don't have to be full of pride about it, full of arrogance.
Yeah.
Well, you can sell yourself, but it's at a only in the purpose of getting the job.
Yeah. To me, sell yourself implies that I'm saying I have qualities I don't have. What I'm saying to her, you know, is if you have the qualities, it's fine. You state that you have the qualities and you can do it. You know, and you can say that without boasting and pretending to be King Kong. You know?
But we're all supposed to get jobs, and we're all supposed to go through an interview.
Right. And you can tell the truth.
Well, it's not. What it is that you're always having to sell. And selling means that you sometimes have to manipulate.
Okay. If you want to sell yourself and manipulate, go ahead.
No, but it's.
Let me finish.
All right.
If you feel it's necessary to sell yourself and manipulate, and you don't want to hear anything contrary to that, that's fine. It's your life. Do what you want. Personally speaking, I don't want to live my life that way. Okay? So each one of us has to make a choice and a decision. You know, what are our values? And we may make different choices and decisions. Okay? And then we own our choices and decisions. So I'm not going to give you permission to do this or not permission to do that. What I'm saying is, I'm saying things, you think about it, and then you make your own decision. Okay, so we don't have to debate it. I am offering something. You think about it, you make your own decision. Okay? I know for myself, I don't want to do that.
Sorry. Okay? The word should have been influence. You have to influence other people.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean you're doing the influencing in a bad way. So that's another thing.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions?
So what what you mean, huh? You are talking about karma, is it?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. I'm talking about karma. I'm talking about personal integrity.
Yes. Is it entirely also cause and effect?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Okay, back here.
Honorable, in your example with the monk that you offered, you were jumping to take out the trash. He might get angry with me, and therefore I'll just go away. So the other thought that sometimes happens is, if I know the other person is going to be angry, and habitually so, and if I do that, will I provoke him and therefore create bad karma by doing that? And therefore, you know, I have this dilemma. Should I actually offer to take it when his reaction's always going to be angry and therefore create bad karma on his behalf because he's generating anger?
So if you know for sure somebody's going to get angry, try not to bait them. Try not to deliberately make them angry. But in this case, I was projecting something due to a past experience. So I was being unreasonable and projecting something bad on him that he didn't necessarily have. Okay. Okay. This will be the last question.
Hi, Venerable. So, in your example about doing, giving to others, showing compassion, and that generates a lot of joy for both people.
Mm-hmm.
And just to hop on your anecdote about the aisle seat, how far do you go until it kind of like backfires on you? Like, what if by giving you put yourself actually in quite a bad state?
Okay, what do you think? Do you think the Buddha's advising you to do that?
I don't.
Okay. Good, you answered your own question.
Thank you.
Okay. We need to think about the teachings. Okay. We hear the teachings, but then we need to think about them. What does something actually mean? Yeah. What does it mean? What does it look like to do this? What are the parameters of doing this? So this is the whole thing of really not just hearing the teachings, but really taking the time to think about them and making examples in your mind and figuring out what they mean. And then also figuring out what your present capacity is. Okay? Buddha isn't saying, you know, pretend to be a Mickey Mouse bodhisattva. Yeah, he's presenting what a bodhisattva is, and that is a model of where we can head towards, where we can serve as a role model. But when we're not there, he's not saying, you know, put yourself in danger and pretend to be Mickey Mouse bodhisattvas, you're going to give away everything you own and, you know, go live on the street. That's ridiculous. I mean, come on, think. Yeah. As the Buddha, you know, Buddha's encouraging us to be generous. Is he encouraging you to give up away your whole bank account and go live, you know, on the street? I mean, come on. Would that be wise advice? No. So, you know, think about it. And then you can figure out kind of what the Buddha really means. And then you also have to assess your own ability. Something may, you know, for Kenzo Rinpoche, giving away that blanket. Wow, he did it with great problem, no attachment, you know. But if you can't give it away with no attachment, and you're going to be angry if you force yourself to give it away, and you're going to hate the beggar afterwards, then it's better you don't give your blanket away, because you're not capable of doing it. Yeah. When we read stories of the bodhisattvas giving away their arms and legs and eyes, it's, you know, it's inspiring us to one day be able to be that free of attachment. But Buddha's not saying go outside and, you know, pluck out your eye, give it to somebody, you know, at the MRT station. You know, he's not saying that. Okay? Yeah. I mean, clearly, when you're not capable of doing something and it's not going to be for lasting benefit, you don't do it. Okay? Okay, so let's sit quietly for a couple of minutes and then we will dedicate. I have to laugh because we always dream up the most extreme situations, you know? Okay, so think about what you learned so that you can take it home and think about it some more. And then let's rejoice that the merit we created as an individual and as a group this evening, and really send that merit out into the universe with our prayers and our dedication, that it ripen in our own enlightenment and the enlightenment of each and every living being. May it ripen in always meeting fully qualified teachers, and in their living long and continuing to teach and guide us. And let's dedicate also so that we can become suitable disciples who can really benefit from the teachings. And let's dedicate that the Buddha's teachings remain in the world for a very long time in a very pure form. Due to this merit, may we so attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Buddha